like to ask for your attention for a few brief thoughts. As I've tried to sketch out yesterday, there is a profound relationship between the quality of mindfulness and these Brahma Viharas. I said this morning, one of the features of mindfulness is that it has an aspect of these Brahma Viharas, and that is what distinguishes it primarily from sort of run-of-the-mill, mundane attention. Mindfulness is both skilled in what it attends to, in other words, the wholesomeness of the object of mindfulness is part of what makes mindfulness different from mere attention. Well, with mere attention, we have no guarantee that the object actually has a wholesome impact on our mind, the object of what we attend to. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is that mindfulness is suffused with the quality of at least one of these Brahma Viharas. Now, these Brahma Viharas are relational, and so is mindfulness. So there is not just an interdependence between the two, but there is also a clear similarity in the fact that both are relational qualities. Now, this may be counterintuitive, because we sometimes think practice is me alone against the universe, isn't it? This is what the individualist perspective is on practice. We see individual cushions, individual mats. We close our eyes, it feels personal. Yeah? It's me in here, and I need to somehow survive in a world out there. But both the Brahma Viharas and mindfulness practice show up that this in here, out there dichotomy is basically a construct of the mind. It's a construct of a form of understanding that is biased. I don't want to drag you into Buddhist philosophy, but if you are interested in such way, in this way, then the dynamic that brings this about is the dynamic of divisive knowing. It's called vijnana. It's a separative knowing. And the rising of sensory experience, which gives me the feeling, because there is something in my senses that appears to be out there, there must be somebody in here to whom that belongs or to whom that happens. Yeah. And whatever it is that arises in your senses and that is cognized, you end up with a feeling, me in here, world out there. And this split is at the root of fundamental misunderstandings. So, a careful mindfulness that attends moment-to-moment experience gradually shows up the falsity of that construction. It gradually shows up that this me-in-here business, world out there, possibly hostile or can be acquired by me and owned by me and appropriated by me. You know, if you're if this is what you intend, that this is an erroneous picture of my situation. It is unreal. It's not unmoral or anything like that. It's just unreal. It doesn't work like that. And that's one of the tasks of mindfulness. So, mindfulness, sometimes underestimated in this function, mindfulness clarifies our perceptions. Mindfulness isn't just the bit that gets your busy mind quiet and that gets you the happiness bit you think you deserve, or, you know, that is the raw material of your blissful samadhi state. Mindfulness also has the job to actually update my perceptions, update my sanya. So, that's one of the reasons why Buddhist meditation across the board is into cultivating mindfulness. It is very, very useful in mundane and everyday situations as current applications of mindfulness in many, many fields from health healthcare contexts, to pedagogical contexts, to educational contexts, to stress reduction contexts for people who have a lot of that, proves. There's a lot of very everyday and very mundane applications, direct good use of mindfulness, of the effects of mindfulness in our lives. We all know that. If we practice that, you'll know that your phone numbers stick better in your memory, you get angry less often, you're more perceptive in what goes on in other people, you have clearer feelings for boundaries, for needs, for your possibilities. It's a very useful thing to have mindfulness, irrespective of awakening, deep samadhi states, and complete liberation from greed and hatred. You know, if that is too much, or if that seems too far away, secretly you fear that these Buddhas are going to take away not just your greed, but also your fun, maybe. Yeah, sometimes these Buddhists kind of get out all the fun of my life. So, or rather stay a scintillating, greedy little self, and learn to suffer less and get the bait off the hook without, get caught. Yeah. So mindfulness has many applications. One of the applications is interesting, is referred to in a little story I'd like to relate to you. The story has an unusual protagonist. Protagonist is a female, a young, we assume something around 10 years old, and she has the unflattering name of being called Frying Pan. Her name is Medakatalika. She had to be rescued from the Burmese scriptural tradition, who tried to turn her into a boy, but she has been redeemed and dutifully restored to her female gender by other editors of the Pali Canon. And she occurs in a place called Sedaka. It's a lost little sutta, and it's a Sutta Nikaya, which I don't know how many of you are reading Buddhist texts. Generally, Buddhist texts are not read. That's the largest amount of Buddhist texts are basically being unread. Then there are some Buddhist texts that are being anthologized and turned into little collections of particularly readable bits, sort of the cherry-picking approach to textual transmission. And then there are the huge collections which hold many, many gems, which are not easily... They would be easily accessible. English has the most of the best translations of these texts from Pali, but, there's something slightly daunting at collections which come at 1,200 pages, a volume or so. And this little story actually occurs in a 1,200-page collection. So it's called the Sedaka Sutta in the Satipatthana Samyutta, grouped sayings on the topic of the applications of mindfulness. And the story goes, this is the Buddha talking to his disciples. He tells them an old story of a bamboo acrobat. Bamboo acrobat, we have to imagine something fairly low-tech. Yeah? This is not a light show, big stage. It's basically a man who obviously has a bamboo pole. We know that he's a low-caste man, so we assume that he puts that bamboo pole either probably here or here, and the girl, who probably climbs on the man and then on the bamboo pole, and her name, Frying Pan, is probably, this is a hunch, we have no textual evidence for this, so you're entirely on faith here. We probably assume that she lies flat at the top of the pole, so that she kind of makes herself rigid and balances at the top of the pole. And the two of them are obviously wandering from village to village performing their act. And the Buddha tells us that the master, he is referred to as master, so we assume that he is the old artist, speaks to his girl and say, okay, Medakatalika, you climb up, I take care of you, you take care of me, and both of us being taken care of in that way, we are performing our art, we're safe, you climb down, we collect the money, and we have a good life. Yeah? And now the interesting bit starts, and the girl disagrees with him and says, Master, it doesn't work like that. You take care of yourself, I take care of myself. This way being taken care of, both of us will perform our art safely and will collect our money and go on living. Says the Buddha, yeah? And then he gives his vote to the girl and says, in this case, she is right. It is not he takes care of her and she takes care of him. It is he takes care of himself and she takes care of herself. And in that way, they both had been taken care of. Yeah? So he gives explicitly his vote to the girl's position, which is unusual. Yeah? And then, having agreed with the girl, siding with her, he weaves, he gives it another spin and say, it is by taking care of oneself that one takes care of the other, and it is by taking care of the other, second spin, that one takes care of oneself. So first of all, he sides with the girl, saying each has to take care of himself or herself first. And then in the second spin, he says, it is by looking after yourself you look after the other. And he adds, almost dialectically, by looking after the other, you look after yourself. And then he says, how does one do that? And that's where I'm actually not going by memory, but I'm hoping to read that short little snippet. This is, by the way, not the book I said it is in. This is one of those... This is one of those cherry-picking anthologies I just spoke of. Or actually, it's a monography rather than an anthology. Gautama then states, that's the Buddha, monks, he who protects himself protects others. He who protects others protects himself. How does one protect himself protect others? By sustaining meditation, by cultivating it, and by practicing it frequently. It is in this way that one protects himself also, that he who protects himself also protects others. So we protect others by being meditators, basically. And how does one protect others by protecting himself? How does one protect others? It is by patience one protects others. It is by harmlessness one protects others. By the condition of love. Interesting, isn't it? So, by loving, one protects others and oneself, and by the condition of tender care. Interesting, yeah? Anudadayata is the Pali, which means by being available and by looking out for. Yeah. And then he continues, monks, in this way, he who protects himself protects others. He who protects others protects himself. So, we are told first by the master, you know, I look after you, you look after that, you look after me, that's so we're both taken care of. Then the girl disagrees and says, no, each one has to look after himself or herself first. The Buddha says, yeah, she's right. And then instead of just leaving it that, he weaves it together and says, but in looking after yourself, you also look after others. So he breaks up that self-other notion. And then he adds, also by looking after others, you actually do look after yourself. Yeah. And then he identifies the major practice in which you protect both yourself, or by protecting yourself, you protect others, is practice. You know, the term is bhavana. This is the major word for meditation. It's not quite straightforward. Because the term meditation is a weird term. It comes from the Latin tradition, meditare means to think deeply. And this is precisely what Buddhist meditation is generally not. You know, and why this term has been used to translate the Buddhist notion of meditation, I've never quite understood. Yeah. It's even more complicated. The Christian traditions who have been the source for the term meditare actually have started using their own word meditation, often in a Buddhist sense, not in the sense of the Benedictine tradition of deep reflection, preceded by the lectio, by the reading, and followed by the contemplatio, which would be the non-conceptual association, a word much closer to Buddhist practices, which for strange reasons not being used for Buddhist practices. The Christians actually have started using the term meditation in the notion of the Buddhists, so that doesn't help matters. But the Pali term basically means culture. Bhavana means develop, bring about, call to life, cultivate. So there's a good reason. This cultivation is not just stillness. It is also Brahmaviharas. That's one way where the Brahmaviharas fall out. If bhavana becomes samatha and vipassana, the Brahmaviharas have already fallen out. But bhavana is more than just samatha or vipassana. It means cultivation of mind. And cultivation of mind is both in terms of wisdom and in terms of stillness and in terms of the capacity to deepen one's resonances, one's empathetic resonances, as I have outlined yesterday. So a little practical example in the context of the Satipatthana exercises, the applications of mindfulness, tells us that we protect others by practicing meditation and by protecting others through patience, through harmlessness, through love, and through tender care. We also practice the protection of ourselves. That's interesting, yeah? Weakens that notion of me and the other. Either it's for me good or it's for you good. It can't be for both. Yeah? This little teaching device and our girl here completely challenges that notion. If it has to be good for me, it must be at your expense. If it has to be good for you, it must be at my expense. So, let's be grateful for frying pan and her teaching device. Let's do some more sitting. Thank you.